Welcome to Asia Calling, your window on Asia. Coming up on the show this week. Each year, unregistered fishing boats haul billions of dollars worth of fish from Indonesian waters. The government is trying to stamp it out by blowing up and sinking the offending boats at sea. Later in the show, we bring you an investigative report on the illegal fishing trade in Indonesia and the Philippines. But before that, we visit a school for grandmothers in India, where women are getting an opportunity that they missed out on as kids. And in Jakarta, the case that's put the city's governor in jail on charges of blasphemy. Thanks for tuning into the show. I'm Nicole Kirby. This week, we start in Jakarta, right here where the show is produced. Over the last 5 months, the city has seen a very public court case, a tense election, and huge demonstrations, the biggest the country has seen since the start of democratic rule nearly 20 years ago. And it all culminated last Tuesday, when Jakarta's governor was sent to jail on charges of blasphemy. Along with KBR reporters, I compiled this report in Jakarta, Indonesia. Last Wednesday, an emotional crowd gathered at Jakarta's City Hall. Dressed in red and white, the colours of Indonesia's flag, they sang national songs, some in tears, some angry, and others sad. The crowd had gathered to show their support for the city's governor, Basuki Cahaya Purnama, better known as Ahok. He'd been sentenced to jail the previous day.
Memperhatikan pasal 156A huruf A KUHP.
Ahok is Christian and ethnic Chinese, in a majority Muslim nation. After a five-month-long court case that left the city divided, Ahok was charged with blasphemy and sentenced to 2 years in prison.
Terbukti secara sah dan meyakinkan bersalah melakukan tindak pidana penodaan agama.
His lawyer, Iwayan Sudirta, told reporters they will fight the decision.
Kita bisa memaklumi, tapi kita kecewa dengan putusan.
We are disappointed with the decision and we will appeal it. We are disappointed because we don't believe that the evidence that was taken into consideration is valid.
In a speech he made last year, Ahok mentioned the Quran verse, Al-Ma'idah 51, telling a crowd not to be fooled into believing that non-Muslims cannot lead Muslims. A video version of the speech then went viral on social media. With an incomplete transcript changing the tone of the comments, the video led hardliners to claim that Ahok's comment was an insult to the Quran and Islam. In Jakarta, mass demonstrations followed, the largest since the fall of the New Order dictatorship in 1998. Hundreds of thousands of Islamic demonstrators demanded Ahok's imprisonment. Andreas Harsono, researcher at Human Rights Watch, says the response reflects a shift in religious culture in Indonesia.
It is obviously an Islamization, a certain kind of Islamization, because, you know, Islam is diverse. Islam has a rich history. But this type of Islam, non-tolerant Islam, discriminatory Islam, is going to be more dominant in the future in Indonesia. Right now, we are already seeing their influence.
Over the last 5 months, in a tense Jakarta, the once widely popular governor divided his days between the campaign trail and the courtroom, campaigning for re-election while also on trial. Before the blasphemy case, Ahok's leadership was held up as a proud symbol of religious pluralism and tolerance, in a country that has witnessed repeated attacks on Christian Chinese minorities throughout its history. But Harsono says Ahok's blasphemy case is part of a trend that's been mounting over 10 years or more.
That Ahok is one important point in a slow, long decline of religious freedom in Indonesia. Ahok Project is not the only one. It is one of more than, I don't know how many, 120, 130 cases over the last 17, 19 years of blasphemy.
More and more cases of blasphemy are now being reported. And when they go on trial, the accused are almost always found guilty. But Indonesian civil society groups and international bodies, including the UN, contest the legitimacy of the law criminalising blasphemy. Pratiwi Febri is a lawyer at the Indonesian Legal Aid Institute, or LBH Jakarta.
Hatred cannot be objectively assessed. Therefore, we do not support the blasphemy law. Twice, the Constitutional Court has recommended that the blasphemy law is inconsistent with the rule of law and principles of democratic governance.
Civil society groups like LBH and Human Rights Watch are pushing to repeal the blasphemy law. After the verdict was handed down on Tuesday morning, Ahok was immediately escorted to jail in an armoured vehicle. In the meantime, his deputy, Jarot, has reluctantly taken over duties as governor.
As vice governor, I offer to act as guarantee for Ahok, so he can be released on parole and continue his service to the community. I think he is very cooperative and will not alter the evidence.
And hundreds of Jakartans have echoed Jarot's offer, pledging signatures and ID cards to act as guarantees for Ahok, a governor who is known for his strong stance against corruption and his support of public infrastructure.
Malam ini kita akan menyalakan 1,000 lilin sebagai tanda solidaritas.
And outside the prison, demonstrators have held candlelight vigils late into the night. Solidarity demonstrations were held in at least 6 other cities around the country, and even in Hong Kong.
Kita dari Papua juga ingin membela kebenaran.
And although his supporters have come out in force, Ahok's opponents argue he deserved a longer 5-year sentence. But Hasono believes that if even a governor backed by the president and the country's largest political party could fall like this, then the promise of justice isn't strong for other Indonesians.
That is scary. How many people will end up like Ahok? And still, Ahok is a big guy. The consequences of this jurisprudence is scary for Indonesia, for the future of Indonesia.
Along with KBR reporters, I'm Nicole Kirby in Jakarta for Asia Calling. They say it's never too late to learn. Well, one unique school in the Indian state of Maharashtra is proving there's some truth to this old saying. As Bismillah Gilani reports, the students at India's first grandmother school are forging a new path as they learn how to read and write just a little bit later in life.
It's early afternoon here in Maharashtra's Phagane village, and dozens of elderly women wearing bright pink saris are walking down the main street in single file. Backpacks are slung over their shoulders and they are carrying abacus slates in their hands. They are on their way to the Ajibaiji Shala, or the grandmother's school. At 60, Kamlabai is the school's youngest student and says she is reliving her childhood.
I was just 12 when I was married off. My parents didn't send me to school. They were poor and had 10 children, so they both work in the fields to make ends meet. We also joined them later, and nobody ever thought about school. But now I'm here trying to make up for the loss. I can now read alphabets and sign my name. It feels so good. It is being like a child again.
Kamlabai has 29 classmates. all with a similar background. According to the 2015 UNESCO Global Education Report, nearly 70% of adults who are illiterate in India are women. Like a conventional school, their day begins with an assembly prayer. After roll call, they recite Marathi alphabets and multiplication tables in chorus. The grandmother's school opened on International Women's Day in March last year. Social activist Yogendra Bangar established the school, but the inspiration, he says, came from the women themselves.
When I start working in this village, some of these women say, "You keep on talking about the importance of education, but what about us? We also want to be able to write our name like others and stop using thumbprints. But how can we do that?" That got me thinking that they didn't get the opportunity to go to school but are so eager to learn. So I decided to start the school for them.
With help from a charitable trust, Bangar started classes in a makeshift bamboo hut. But on the first anniversary, the school was shifted into a new concrete building. Classes run for 2 hours in the afternoon, 6 days a week. They are timed to enable the women to complete their household chores before attending the school. Sheetal More is the school's only teacher. One of the students is her own mother-in-law, and she says teaching her elders is a daunting task.
I teach each of them one alphabet a day. We're going very slowly, but many of them have a weak memory and they forget, which means going through the lessons over and over again. Some of them are hard of hearing and I have to be louder. They're not like children you can shout at or scold. They're grandmothers and it requires a lot of patience.
Most of these women are widows. The school offers much needed respite from the restrictions and reclusive life that tradition seeks to impose on them. Even their pink uniform symbolizes a departure from the age-old custom that requires widows to wear white clothes as a sign of mourning. 65-year-old Anusuya Bai enjoys every bit of her time at the school.
This is a good thing that has happened to us. We are really happy about it. We come here, sit together, chat, and enjoy the atmosphere and company of other women. It is fun.
While women in India continue to lag behind in literacy, the government is trying to address the issue with a slew of programs exclusively focusing on women's education. That may improve the situation for younger generations, but many older women feel they have already missed out. For at least some of them, initiatives like the Grandmother's School offer a rare chance to catch up on lost time. From New Delhi, this is Bismillah Gilani for Asia Calling.
You're listening to Asia Calling KBR. Indonesia is an island nation with roughly 18,000 islands. And between them lies a vast expanse of sea, seething with fish. The extensive area is difficult to patrol and illegal fishing is rampant, with unregistered boats from neighbouring countries entering Indonesia's waters and taking huge hauls of fish. This two-part series explores the illegal fishing trade from Indonesia and the Philippines. It's a joint investigation by KBR, Jaring and Katadata. Here's part one. A small boat precariously weaves its way through crashing waves. The noisy motor struggles through choppy waters. We're heading to Sarangani Island in Davao, the Philippines, and to the home of Florita Magaso. She's worrying for her husband, Matthew Magaso, and her two sons, Jeffrey and Jerick, who are now in an Indonesian jail.
Matthew has been arrested probably around 5 times since he's been involved in tuna fishing. My son Jeffrey has been arrested 2 times. According to Matthew and Jeffrey, of all the Filipinos detained in Indonesia, they have the longest sentences.
Jeffrey is serving a 5-year sentence and his father Matthew 3 years, on top of combined fines of $185,000. The Filipino men were found guilty of fishing inside Indonesian waters in January 2015. Matthew and Jeffrey were the captains of 2 small ships, Garuda 5 and Garuda 6. Their boats were illegally fishing in the Talud waters of the Sulawesi Sea, that is Indonesian waters close to the Philippines, when an Indonesian patrol boat caught them. The crew of another 17 Filipino ships were arrested at the same time. The Indonesian city of Bitung in North Sulawesi is known as Kota Cakalangan, or Skipjack Tuna City, because of the wealth of tuna in surrounding waters. 312 nautical miles away, or 30 hours by boat across the Sulawesi Sea, sits the Filipino port of General Santos. And that's where Indonesia's tuna is flowing, robbing Indonesia of the fish they should rightfully own, claims Susi Pujastuti, Indonesian Minister of Maritime Affairs and Fisheries. She says catches are often transferred from one ship to another in the middle of the ocean.
Transshipments take place in the middle of the sea. From Bitung, our task force investigation found that of 3 catches in the area, 2 were taken to General Santos and just 1 was brought back to Bitung.
Illegal, unreported, unregulated fishing, IUU, costs Indonesia at least an estimated $3 billion a year, according to the Association for Southeast Asian Nations. Neighbouring countries like Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand and the Philippines fish in Indonesian waters because their own waters are depleted through overfishing, says Susi, and moratoriums on commercial fishing are often in place.
So apparently they are desperate because our neighboring countries have moratoriums on fishing in their marine territories. So the pressure to catch in our water is huge.
Since 2015, under Susi's leadership, Indonesia has patrolled its waters with renewed vigour, attempting to safeguard the nation's food stocks and prosperity into the future. There are now 35 patrol boats in waters to the north of Indonesia, as well as radars working to detect illegal fishing boats. In 2016 alone, at least 115 foreign ships were dramatically blown up and sunk at sea. Although sinking is intended as a deterrent measure, Susi maintains that illegal fishing continues unabated.
We have introduced regulations and rules, but there are many violations. Many entrepreneurs are still unwilling to report their catches openly and correctly.
Seeking the fish-rich waters of Indonesia, Filipino fishers buy fake Indonesian ID cards in an attempt to deceive patrols. They're bought for around $50 to $75, and North Sulawesi Police spokesperson Majuki says the fake IDs have been supplied by officials in the Indonesian Department of Population and Civil Registration.
From our investigation, we know that the fake ID card was provided by an officer in Bitung. We had evidence from the witnesses. The officer and the ship owner's agent both have been arrested.
Since mid-January, 166 Filipinos have been detained in Bitung. But despite crackdowns, illegal fishing continues. With her husband and sons behind bars in Indonesia, Florita concedes that her family risks the Sulawesi Sea for riches and they're paying the price.
Yes, they broke the law. That's why they just accepted detention. They cannot do anything about that. But we just hope someone could help them, so that their sentence would be reduced, so they won't reach up to 3 years there.
For Asia Calling, this report is a KBR, Jaring and Katadata collaboration in Indonesia and the Philippines. Join us next week for part 2, where we meet officials who are driving the illegal trade from the Filipino side. Do you ever think about how rubbish could be used to make shelters, beautiful furniture, or even a swimming pool? Well, one Pakistani researcher has been working on that challenge for more than two decades. Nargis Latif has dedicated her life to recycling and putting to good use tons of garbage produced in Pakistan's industrial hub, the city of Karachi. Asia Calling correspondent Naeem Sahutra has this report.
Life moves at a fast pace in Karachi, Pakistan's economic and commercial hub. The port city is home to 20 million people, and each day waste piles up. Some 20,000 tons of garbage is produced in the city each day. That's Nargis Latif's area of expertise.
Assalamu alaikum. How's your work going on?
Fine.
Yeah.
The 63-year-old researcher has been working on the rubbish problem for more than two decades. Latif's workshop resembles something of a junkyard amid a sea of high-rises in the upscale Gulchan Iqbal neighborhood. Bamboo, cardboard, packing material, and other bits of reused junk are scattered all around.
So I have always worked on those items which nobody wants to touch.
Latif recycles everything.
This started in 1994. Well, I was fed up of the garbage burning in the city, the filth, the waste all over. In fact, this was the very first year I did a lot of research. And this is, after all that studying, I came to the conclusion that there was money involved and that if people could be attracted to this businessman, if people would start dealing in garbage, buying and selling of garbage, then there would be no garbage left. And then I started getting practically involved. And the deeper and deeper I got into it, I found out that there's a lot of innovation and a lot of new products that could come up, which would change the economy of the country and of the world. This process, what we did was I started with a bank called Garbage and Gold Bank. So we started these gold coins, which was actually 17, 18 karat gold. And this we would give in exchange for garbage. You know, there used to be these weekly bazaars, and we would have a stall there, and it would act like a bank, where women used to, especially mostly this attracted women and rich women. They would bring their dry waste, like any kind of paper, plastic, metal. But whenever it equaled one coin of gold, the amount of garbage, we would give them a piece of gold. And in those days, it used to cost about it used to be 500 rupees.
And what was response?
Response was was tremendous. In fact, some very big ladies, they collected lots of coins.
In a city that lacks a proper waste management system, garbage is a big problem in Karachi. And sometimes corrupt officials tasked with collecting rubbish and burning it to save on transportation costs. So Latif's initiative, a first small scale, has since grown and made an impact, creating an awareness that there is value in rubbish and in recycling.
In fact, you can say has been our success point. It became a movement. It spread all over the city. I've never just confined myself to just one innovation. Well, one, I won't say motive, but one thing that sustained me all this time was my desire to discover, to do research, which was my desire from my ambition from childhood, that I wanted to become a scientist.
Soon the research center turned into this workshop, a space where waste is transformed. In the middle of the room, for example, is a shining silver structure. Latif calls it her latest discovery, the Chandi.
Now the latest I will talk about is the Chandi technology. The Chandi technology is now getting global attention. This technology we are using, it's called metallized film. And this metallized film is the packing material in which different kinds of food items are being sold all over the world, not just Pakistan, everywhere.
The silver structure is made from construction blocks filled with metallic wrappers, waste from the packets of biscuits, chips, and other goods. Stacks of plastic silver bricks form the walls of the Chandi, while a layer of the blocks over a net of bamboo make up the roof. Just behind us, five workers are busy making construction blocks from waste. Each one weighs 5 kilograms and is 4 times larger a normal brick.
From this technology, these blocks and panels, you can have your furniture, water reservoir, your house, move it around, make it small, big, table, chairs, sofas, beds, swimming pool. So many things you can do with it.
Hundreds of people are using the furniture that has been produced in Latif's workshop so far, including an NGO that has purchased some of the bricks to build shelters for displaced families. Latif says it is these successes, discoveries, and innovations that have motivated her to keep going, the inspiration to continue her decades-long work. For Asia Calling, this is Naim Sohotra in Karachi, Pakistan.
That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced in the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about our show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Asia Calling for more updates. You can now also podcast the show. Go to the iTunes store or your podcasting app and search for Asia Calling and subscribe for free to the weekly episodes. I'm Nicole Kirby, back next week with more stories from Asia.